Good evening. Welcome to Council Connection for March. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. This month, we'll be hearing from Massachusetts Senator Michael Barrett, who spoke to us at our fall conference back in December. But we'll start with the story of a project undertaken by ACB's Audio Description Project. Here's Susan Glass to tell us more. Good evening, Susan. Welcome back to the show, and good to have you on again.
Thank you. It's an honor to be back.
Well, now, last time we talked, which was in October, the Beatty contest was just being launched, if I remember correctly.
That is right. We were just getting the publicity out to various schools throughout the country and putting it out on affiliates, news areas and so on. And so the contest has happened, and we have winners, and ACB actually released a press release about it last week.
So. Oh, great. Great.
Yep. So pretty exciting.
Can you give a little bit of a recap of what the contest is and how it worked?
Sure. So the Beatty contest stands for Benefits of Audio Description in Education. And we really wanted it to be Batty, but we couldn't think of a second D because we thought kids wanted to be Batties, and this is a contest for kids. But the Beatty Awards are from the Listening is Learning initiative of the American Council of the Blind's Audio Description Project, as well as the Described and Captioned Media Program, which is a program that is available. It's a database of programs that is captioned for people with hearing impairments, and we wanted to put the two programs together for this initiative. And so we think of the Audio Description Project as ADP. Described Captioned Media Program is DCMP. So for future reference, if I throw those acronyms around, that's what I mean. But in any case, this contest has been around for a time. It used to be called the Young Film Critics Award, and it started at least 10 or 12 years ago, and then we revived it this year through the work of a really inspired committee, and I'd like to mention these colleagues in ACB, if I may.
Oh, by all means, go ahead.
Real hardworking people. We had Donna Brown, who is a member of the American Association of Blind Teachers and who teaches at the West Virginia School for the Blind in Romney, West Virginia. Sheila Young, who is a teacher based in Florida. Dan Spoon is chair of the Audio Description Project Steering Committee, which has to corral all seven audio description committees in the work that we do. So he has the cat herding position, extraordinaire.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, Margie Donovan from Sacramento, California, was a member of the committee. Myself, Susan Glass, Dr. Joel Snyder, director of the Audio Description Project, and Jason Stark, CEO and director of DCMP, Described Caption Media Program. And we met on a monthly basis and put the contest together and got it rolling and got publicity notices out. And the star publicizing individual was Ms. Donna Brown.
Yes.
I don't know what she did, but she had everybody from her school excited about this, and we had 25 entries into our contest, and many of them came from the West Virginia School for the Blind.
Was there anybody there from Massachusetts?
There was not this year. So hello to my Massachusetts friends, and please don't feel too badly that there aren't Massachusetts representatives. The students this year came from Virginia, West Virginia, Texas, Georgia, and South Dakota and California. So there's a lot of states in the union that we still want to hear from, and certainly Massachusetts is at the top of that list.
Yeah.
But at least we got a start. Now, people might be curious to know what the contestants were actually asked to do.
Yes.
And what they were asked to do was to watch an audio described film or video, and it could be an educational film that they saw in their school. And that's where DCMP came in, because they have many, many described and captioned videos. Or it could be a film of a student's choosing, just a mainstream film that happened to have description. And the student needed to write a review of the film, 250 words maximum, so it could be shorter than that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the review, tell us which specific parts of the audio description gave the student the most vivid pictures of what was happening in the film? How did the audio description make you feel? How did it help you learn? Which description did you like best, and which did you not like, and why? So it was less of a review of the film and more a review of the audio description occurring within the film. That said, students could take a sentence or two to provide a brief summary, but summary was the least of what they were supposed to do. We had three categories, sophomore, junior, and senior of students, and they ranged in ages from 7 to 21. And when I read the winners, I'll tell you what the exact age range of each category was. But we deliberately assigned those divisions because when you're 7 to 10 years old, you write a different kind of review than when you're 11 to 15, and yet again a different kind of review than when you're 15 to 21. And we wanted to be fair about that.
Yeah.
And so we, on the committee, we also broke into pairs to read and rank and judge the essays. But we wanted to be clear about that, you know, if I'm 7, I might only write 3 sentences, but they might be really good sentences.
Sure.
And I should be rewarded for that.
That's right.
And I could be 20 and write something that goes on and doesn't say anything. So that doesn't just, you know, that doesn't necessarily cut it either. It's finding that subject matter and saying what it is that you need
That's
to
right.
say and being criteria-based and rich and succinct about it.
So let's read the list of winners here, because I know that was done at ACB Midyear.
Sure, I will do that. The grand prize winner is Miss Abby Moreno of Lowell High School in San Francisco, California. And she may be joining us in Reno this summer. She's interested in doing that, in coming to the national convention, where these awards will be announced yet again.
Good.
So we really hope we get to see Abby. I won't tell you what she wrote about, because there's a good possibility that the winners are going to be reading their essays or talking about what it was like to be in the contest on ACB Radio. We don't know yet which show, but there will be an opportunity to hear directly from the contestants
yeah.
at that time. So Abby Moreno won our grand prize, and she was also first place in the juniors category. So I'm moving on now to the senior category, and that's ages 16 to 21.
Okay.
First place went to Breck Morrissey of Flower Mound High School in Highland Village, Texas. Second place was awarded to Kayuja Person from Nansemond River High. That's a beautiful name.
Mm.
Nansemond River High School in Suffolk, Virginia. Then for our junior, there was not a third place awarded in the senior categories. So we move now to the juniors category, and that's ages 11 through 15. And our first place winner, also our grand prize winner, was Abby Moreno from Lowell High School in San Francisco. The second place winner was Shelby DeHigh from South Dakota School for the Blind and Visually Impaired in Miller, South Dakota. The third place winner was John Holstein of the West Virginia School for the Blind at Romney, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to the sophomore category, ages 7 to 10, we had first place awarded to Audrey Mattingly from the West Virginia School for the Blind, Romney, West Virginia. Second place awarded to Fernando Moran Padilla of Santa Rita Elementary School in Salinas, California. Third place was awarded to Townsend Stemple. Guess where from? West Virginia School for the Blind, Romney, West Virginia.
There you go.
So those were our winners. And the way our prizes work out, our grand prize winner, Abby Moreno, wins an iPad Mini, I think. I can't remember if it's an iPad or an iPad Mini.
In either case, it's a nice prize.
It's a nice prize. And
yeah.
then she also gets a $100 iTunes gift certificate, and she will receive an awards certificate from ACB as well. And her resource teacher, her TBI, will receive a $100 Amazon gift card. And you may know that classroom supplies can be expensive and that school districts do not always provide everything one needs.
That's right.
So that's right. We wanted to make sure that all TBIs received recognition and awards as well. I might add she wrote a very nice heartwarming note back to Joel Snyder thanking the committee and asking about the Reno conference and such. So that was really special. Second place winners in all categories will of course receive an award certificate, and they will receive $50 iTunes gift cards, and their teachers will receive $100 Amazon gift cards. The third place winners will receive $25 iTunes gift cards, award certificates, and their teachers will also receive the $100 Amazon gift cards. And then for those students who entered but did not place, they will each receive a certificate of recognition that they entered the contest and a $10, I believe it's a Target gift card. We were going to get them iTunes cards too, and iTunes didn't have cards at the $10 level. So I think we went and got Target. Kids can find things at Target. So we wanted to make sure that everyone who entered this contest left as a winner.
Yes.
And as a recognized person who would be wanting to enter again next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add that the board generally generously budgeted some money toward this, and then the members of the Beatty Selection Committee pitched in and made the prizes possible as well. So we all believe in kids, and we all believe in their success.
Now, and this thought just occurred to me as you're talking. If, say, a state affiliate wanted to contribute somehow, could they do that too? I mean, we know that ACB did, but could a state affiliate do that too if they were so inclined?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, this is great news for you, and I think what I'm hoping is that it's motivation for people here in Massachusetts to get involved in this next year when the contest comes around, and not only will you win a prize, perhaps, but you'll be doing a great thing for yourself and for others.
Yep, for your school.
Yeah,
that's school recognition too. It's very exciting.
That's right.
And we'll be coming out of the gates running in early September, getting this publicized early. And in fact, I think we have to get our publicity materials ready by the end of July. That's the way the schedule worked this year, so it'll happen fast.
Well, and we will here at Council Connection, we'll keep our finger on the pulse, so to speak. And who knows? Maybe you'll be back on in September with more Beatty news.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you again, Susan, for joining us tonight.
All right.
Take care.
Good evening.
You're listening to Council Connection on the Talking Information Center Network. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit www.acbofma.org and look for the Council Connection. Regardless of how you feel about the outcome of our presidential election, it's clear that at the moment we're living under a great deal of political and economic uncertainty. At our fall conference last December, Democratic State Senator Michael Barrett gave us some ideas on how to cope with this uncertainty. Let's listen in as he shares his unique perspective.
Very happy to be here and realize when we scheduled this conversation, we hadn't had a presidential election yet. Don't want that minor event in advocacy to just slip by us. So I do want to talk about it just a little bit. Most of the time I've spent in the last 2 weeks has been in hand-wringing and worry. And I think I'm overdoing it, and I suspect some of you are overdoing it as well. There are going to be real opportunities perversely in what no doubt is going to be the most tumultuous presidency this country has seen in over a century. Difficult times are ahead, but there's real openings here. And it's time that all of us pivot to a more positive outlook and to seeing those opportunities. And I want to tell you what I mean, because I want your participation. I want you guys, many of you are leaders within your community, and I define your community as where you live, as the church you go to, what you believe in, what party you're registered in. I'm not for a moment suggesting that any of us is defined by a disability or an ability. We wear many, many different hats in this world. Under Donald Trump, we're going to have to try them all on. Right? And we're going to have to be creative in a number of ways. One thing that I'm exploring and that I need the help of everybody in Massachusetts with is that for the first time in our lifetimes, we're going to have to explore an idea that we've normally associated with arch conservatives, and that's states' rights, right? The fact is we do have a system of checks and balances, and we've tended to feel frustrated about them when people we've liked have been president, among them Barack Obama, who I think is going to go down as one of the best presidents of the 20th century. What dignity, what sense of reserve, what judgment? We're going to miss those qualities, I suspect, more than ever in the next 4 years, right? But let's go back to those checks and balances that at times we've chafed under during the Obama presidency, where all we've seen are checks, it seems, and obstructions at moments. This is when the original constitutional model for this country is really going to be put to the test. I'm talking about the next 4 years. And the checks and balances come in two flavors. You know this, because we're now talking about eighth grade civics. It's worth reminding ourselves of it, though, nevertheless. You've got the checks and balances in Washington itself. You've got three branches of government. They all happen. Two of the three at the moment are under the control, it's true, of, I should say, no, I'm going to amend that. One of the branches, the legislature, is under the control of very conservative folks, mainstream, sometimes Tea Party Republicans. I'm not criticizing Tea Party Republicans. This is just an observation. Some of you may be Tea Party Republicans. Let's assume, though, that in any event, the legislature is in the hands of conservative folks. The Supreme Court, the judiciary, actually in the hands of many progressives. We're going to obsess about Mr. Trump's appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court. The fact is that Obama's appointed more lower federal court judges successfully than any recent president. Actually, the Republicans gave him a little wiggle room there. So you've got a lot of courts at the local federal district court judges at the local levels who are going to have a lot of impact on disability issues and a whole bunch of other things. And they are, by and large, a progressive group. And they will remain progressive even if the Supreme Court, those nine people, tilt conservative during Trump's initial 4 years. So you've got a conservative branch in the Congress. You've got actually a surprisingly progressive branch in the judiciary, which brings us to the presidency and to the executive branch in Washington. It's worth reminding ourselves. Now, I'm an old dude. I know a lot of you folks, I can tell, are spring chickens. This is not the first time as a progressive Democrat I've been disappointed in the presidency. I remember 1968, when at the height of the Vietnam War, Richard Nixon was elected president. A shock to people who had supported Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. That seemed like the end of the world, like things would never get better. And then in 1972, Richard Nixon reelected. War still going on. Surely that had to be the bleakest moment, or so I thought, that I would experience in our national politics as a then young adult. 1980, the most philosophically conservative president, more conservative than Donald Trump, Ronald Reagan, was elected in 1980. Right? That certainly was a setback that we would never survive. And in the year 2000, Al Gore won the popular vote, lost the presidential election to George Bush. We've survived all those setbacks, setbacks by my definition, not necessarily by yours, I can appreciate. And we still elected the nation's first African-American president 8 years ago. So this country has been divided since its inception, right? We really are struggling to define ourselves. We're a young place still. We're not quite sure what we want to be as a nation. Isolationist, internationalist, progressive, conservative. We survive these voyages. We do well. And we're going to survive the next 4 years also. Even though Donald Trump, I think, is going to take us on a wild ride. But let's talk about states' rights in one other sense. We've been talking about the feds. The balance of powers is also about the authority of state governments versus the federal government. I want you folks to devote your reading and your discussion and your thought to the division of responsibilities between the states and Washington, D.C., because you can do a great deal of good, regardless of who's president, if you focus on the notion of state governments as, you know, laboratories of democracy is one phrase that's used. It does mean that in conservative states, women's health, for example, is going to see a real setback as women lose the right to choose in conservative states. But it is also true that states' rights and the checks and balances between the state and federal governments mean that Massachusetts is in a position to protect women at every critical juncture. So we can begin to explore this conservative notion of the states pushing back against the feds, which we didn't like during the civil rights years at all. We can begin to explore that and develop that with the help of people here to ask the question, how can Massachusetts truly lead? How can we stand apart when we need to, with other states when we must, and set the right balance? I know we can do that. But it does take a lot of advocacy. Let's turn to Beacon Hill. And I'm not going to talk for too much longer, Carl. I know you've got a lot of work to transact this morning. But we've seen real gains over the course of even the last 12 months. I happen to be a fan for a whole bunch of reasons of Uber and Lyft and the other ride-sharing organizations. I'm a critic of the ride, the MBTA's attempt to provide accessible transportation for people with all manner of physical and cognitive challenges. I think you're going to see, thanks to some the work done by some of the people in this room and the work done by Carl and others, I think you're going to see improvements over the ride in the kind of public transit and mobility options available to people with all kinds of physical challenges. That's a very good thing. And it came about because people like you know how to lobby. There's only one secret, only two secrets, I should say, to lobbying on Beacon Hill. I'm going to share both of them with you. One is don't regard it as a black box, as a kind of a magical mystery tour that you've somehow got to negotiate, but that you can never truly understand because all you read about or hear about are all the weird things we politicians do. We do weird things. But not most of the time. Most of the time, what we do is work and negotiate between people tugging us in different directions. Don't be intimidated by the need to march up to Beacon Hill. You personally showing up in the office of your state representative or your state senator makes more of an impact than you would think. The staff, I'll tell you what my staff does. They count the people who come in my door, and they give me periodic numerical reports. I ask them, because I really need to know, how many people write me on a given topic. And they'll tell me 125 people wrote you in the last 2 weeks asking that we reform the Electoral College and somehow provide for the direct election of the president, right? I care. When you write an email, when you make a phone call, I hear about it. So the first of the two lobbying secrets you need to know is don't be intimidated by the fact that it isn't your world every day the way that it's mine. I don't know your world. I don't know your work experience or your retirement experience every day. You're a mystery to me. I can appreciate that we mischievous politicians seem at times like a mystery to you. It isn't that complicated. It's basically one human being making a case to another. The other secret of this business is that most of this stuff, most of the important work is around details. And this is where I'd like the vision impaired community and others to provide the kind of focus that Carl brings to his job. This is all about getting the fine print right. And that is where lobbying becomes a little gnarly. It isn't a matter of financial contributions, to be perfectly honest with you, most of the time. It isn't a matter of, but it is a matter of being able to argue the importance of specific wordings in specific laws. And that's, I appreciate real work, not always fun either, but it's critical that you get the details right. And that's why work with lobbyists, they can be volunteer lobbyists, they can be people in this room, but giving them the authority to negotiate language becomes so important. I think that in the next 2 years, in the next 3 years, if we use this states' right concept correctly, and if we really ask the question, not how is the president scaring us, but how can state government be a legitimate constitutional countervailing weight to the federal government and to the presidency? Thinking about that question is going to, I think, enable us to do a lot of good things. I happen to be a technophile. I believe in what technology is going to bring to people with impairments. I think the best times are ahead of us. You guys have already, I know a lot of you work with tech. You know that things are enormously improved compared to 20 years ago. I think they're going to get better yet. You know what they say about the internet, and it's worth your remembering. And it's kind of it is a paradox, right? Change in technology comes slower than you've been led to expect, but makes a profounder difference than you were led to hope. We hype breakthroughs in accessibility so early before they become mainstream that it seems like it takes an age for what you've been reading about or hearing about to really be available to you. That's true, by the way, not just of accessibility breakthroughs. That's true of the internet in general. That's true of mapping the human genome. We've heard about it for 20 years. It seems as if the fruits of mapping the genome occur very grudgingly. So in technology, the change always comes more slowly than you've been led to expect. The ultimate difference is more profound than we might have hoped. These changes, once they finally take root, can alter our lives for the better. So, and the presidency of the United States, as important as it is, does not alter the fact that we're going to make progress in Massachusetts and in accessibility, regardless of who happens to be sitting in the White House. So these are exciting times. Let's pivot, as I say, away from worry about what might happen and focus on the opportunities that the age presents. They are enormous. We're going to get a lot done. Here in Massachusetts, there isn't a Republican-Democratic divide. People work pretty well across the aisle. That's going to continue. I would like to see you guys up in the State House occasionally visiting your local legislators because, as I say, it makes an enormous difference. We're just human beings. We're all doing the best we can. With your help, we'll do a little better. Thank you very much. Yeah. So Carl's asked me just to touch briefly on the budget process. And this is an interesting situation. budgets, the most important thing about budgets is that last year's spending amount tends to carry over. I mean, if we want to be candid about it. What we're working on in a budget situation always, you know, the budget is a bill. It's a law that has to get adopted every year, right? It happens to include a whole bunch of dollar signs in it, but essentially it's the renewal of a previous effort with changes at the margin. So the challenge for you guys and for anyone is to take a look at the amount that's getting spent now and ask, can we marginally make this better, or is there a danger that it's going to become marginally worse? Your job is to build on a foundation and improve it at these outer edges and avoid seeing any worsening. That's a doable achievement. And I'll tell you, there are lots of ways to get the job done, as Carl knows. For one thing, the budget these days is the primary vehicle, and this doesn't make any sense, but that's why it's political, right? We're talking politics here. The budget is the primary vehicle for actually enacting laws, for enacting non-financial language that can alter and improve, I hope, the programs that you guys are interested in. Now, why should that be the case? Well, it started out a century ago innocently. You don't just appropriate money. Consider money for your household. Consider or imagine sitting around your kitchen table and you decide you want to go on a vacation this year. So you're going to plan in your family budget to get down to Florida. I just said Florida. So now you're not just talking about a dollar amount. You're talking about a destination. You're in your head not only appropriating money within the family budget, but you're directing its use. That need to constantly provide direction to the expenditure of tax dollars has led to an explosion of creative legislating within the budget itself. So the budget is actually a hybrid beast. It's an appropriation of money and then a lot of language conditioning how the money shall be spent. People write entire new laws when they add that conditioning language. So the budget process is really a matter of setting the family budget, but then adding all these conditions, destinations, and changes in how it's going to be spent. You're basically doing a year's worth of legislating in this annual process.
This is Bob Hachet. Thank you so much for coming today. My question is about things we keep hearing about revenue shortfalls and potential 9C cuts that the governor may or may not make.
Well, it could happen. I want to confirm the threat because it's good to be on one's toes. We're going to get one more estimated revenue amount. I think we're going to get November revenue collections maybe as early as next week, right? That'll be 5 months into the 12-month fiscal year that began in July. My hope is that it'll show an uptick in revenue. There is no real reason why we should be experiencing the threat of 9Cs, so-called. The state's economy is in very good shape. Actually, as we're learning, Obama's going to leave the national economy in increasingly good shape. So the governor should not be 9Cing this time. I think he should continue to buy time, delaying until the last quarter of the year. Any cuts that then had to be made might be grievous. But the fact is, with the national economy in good shape, unemployment still going down, right? Unemployment in Massachusetts being below that. We're now in the threes. We're about 3.9% and falling. There's no reason why income tax collections and sales tax collections shouldn't be blipping up as a consequence. I'm asking the governor to delay 9Cs, especially on smaller accounts where the dollar amounts are not game-changing, right? He should be delaying it. I'm going to ask that he do so. If the economy were in a different trajectory, I think he'd be more justified. So I can't predict what he's going to do, but I think he's held off a little bit, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for what this week's headlines will show in terms of revenue collections for last month.
This is Deanne Elliott. I'm the legislative chair, and we were very happy to support your health care disparity bill. I'm wondering if you had plans to reintroduce it.
Yeah, let me talk about that. And first of all, thank you. Thank you for supporting it. You know, politics, remember I told you that politics isn't as mysterious as we might think, but it's basically about people pulling and tugging in different directions. So here's a classic example. It's heartbreaking, but you have to maintain a, I won't say a sense of humor, but you have to keep a smile on your face. Health disparities first came along as a concern about civil rights, and understandably so. So we create a commission way back in the day, although we then failed to fund it, that will focus on differences in health care accorded people depending on what race or ethnicity they hail from. So the focus is on race and ethnicity. You know, am I Italian-American and am I Irish-American and am I Latino, and race. Years go by, and remember, I'm in healthcare IT, so I read the private research material. Well, health disparities, the study of whether you are penalized or benefited depending on some characteristic you have as a human being, explodes as a research field. Lots starts to emerge about health disparities according to disability status. So I offered an amendment 2 or 3 years ago that changed the commission's mandate so that it would include race, ethnicity, and disability. A second bill comes along that would finally provide a staff to this commission that sits as a group of non-paid part-time appointees but with no implementation ability. Now we're going to create an Office of Health Equity that enables the Commission on Health Disparities to really have some day-to-day presence in policymaking. The issue arises again as to whether people with disabilities are going to be included in acknowledgement of more recent disparities research. Amazingly enough, I think it's amazing, but it's also just a sign of how complicated we are as human beings. The proponents of limiting the commission to its original charge of race and ethnicity say no. We're not getting enough resources as it is. We don't want to share the precious few dollars we're going to get with folks who might want research done into how health policies distribute disparities on the basis of disability. But you know what? Because, again, life is complex. I have fellow colleagues in the Senate who took a look at my success in adding disability and said, you know what, we need gender. Women have a hell of a time sometimes getting a lot of the clinical trials in this country on drugs are done on with dosages that assume human weight measured by males only, and we tend to be heavier on balance. So you've got the wrong dosage amounts being given to women. In part because little attention is given to the disparities that exist there in terms of research. So Karen Spilka of the Senate understandably adds gender and wants to add that. Now we've got folks who want race and ethnicity the sole focus, competing with those of us who are concerned about disability and those of us who are concerned about gender. I haven't even mentioned sexual orientation. You want to see some real crying examples of people who experience discrimination in health research, consider those who are not anything other than heterosexual. They, too, might like to be heard. Here's what I'm going to do, I'd love your support this year. I think that even I made a mistake. I wanted to include people with disabilities in that health disparities thing, and I, for a while, overlooked all the other ways that you can slice us and dice us as people. I'd like to add omnibus language. That's what federal legislation already includes. So there would be something like, let's research and let's eliminate disparities in providing health care, especially under government programs that somehow differentially impact people on the basis of race, ethnicity, disability status, gender, sexual orientation, and anything else that the research might reveal to be important. We need that catch-all language. We need to get over doing even what I propose to do, which is to add one more potentially impacted group. I'd like your help in finally are getting this right and embodying, I should say, mandating these folks to be thoughtful about disparities wherever they may arise and to give them enough flexibility to catch the next problem if it turns out to be one.
All right, so I'll be quick. First of all, I want to thank you for your leadership and your guarded optimism with the new administration. I do think we in the disability community have to be careful to make sure that we frame our issues in ways that will gather support. For example, this new president-elect hates regulations. So rather than, we were just talking about audio description, we have to be careful. Rather than say we want to regulate the TV and the media community, we have to come up with slogans like make TV great again or make the media accessible for every American, for every great American. But I know image is a critical factor with this president, and we have to be careful in how we pose our issues. We're liberating, we're not restricting. I do have a question though on resources. You know, every year we go to Blind Day, and then I've been involved in education, and we're hustling for money for K-12, and universities get hurt. At some point, we have to recognize we're dealing with a limited pie. We're in a great state, and the Boston area is booming, not so much in other parts of the state. And I do think we're going to have to deal with revenue. Our state income tax is down. The gasoline tax, people are buying, those who see buying more fuel efficient cars. So in effect, they're driving as much, but paying less tax because their gas is cheaper. And if we're going to maintain the quality of services and the progressiveness of this state and our infrastructure, education and services of people with disabilities, we have to be more assertive about talking, increasing the revenue stream. So I think, you know, all of us have to support for 2018, I don't know what it's called, the millionaire surplus tax or whatever people are, how it's going to be framed. And I also want to put out there that those of us in the disabled community, when we come and talk about issues like transportation and the ride, and we're going to become an increasingly older population in Massachusetts, more people over 65, maybe we should be also realistically talking about that people who have incomes, who have disabilities, who are over 65, who need those ride services, should be paying a different rate or, you know, a graduated fee. And so to help support that important transportation service.
I'm sorry, what is your name?
Bill Henderson.
Boy, Bill, I like your thinking. We're gonna be facing, just to build on Bill's thoughts, because he's got me thinking. We're gonna be facing some interesting choices, and we're gonna have to make some unconventional tactical decisions, right? So let's build on one implication of Bill's statement. Trump says, and a lot of the Republicans will say that they dislike identity politics. They're sick and tired, they're going to say, of a typical progressive democratic advocacy for one subgroup of Americans at the time. Now, we know that they're not making these arguments entirely in good faith, but still, they have kind of a point. We know that we wear many different hats, and one of them is just the American hat. We're all kind of in this together. The future can be scary for everybody. Doesn't matter what your race, gender, sexual orientation, or religion is. The future is always unknowable. And that can leave you feeling off balance. And a lot of Trump supporters voted for the change candidate. I'm not saying this is fair, but there's a kind of fairness to it. My candidate, Hillary, ran as the candidate of continuity. She proposed to continue the Obama years, but better. Trump ran as the disruptor. Well, 8 years ago, Obama ran as the disruptor. He was going to disrupt George H.W. Bush and the Republican hegemony, and he had ideas of his own, which I love. Trump was actually, in terms of promising disruption and shaking things up, in an odd way, Obama's heir, albeit with a different ideological component. Well, okay. Let's take him at his word. He wants, as did Obama, he wants us to be in a post-racial society. He wants us to be in a post-identity group or identity politics society. Then I think all of us, and we all have disabilities, by the way, of one sort or another. Some of us just don't know it yet. We're all members of the Disability Caucus. It's only a matter of time and luck and a few other things. So why not have the vision impaired community visiting legislators and not just asking, you want to ask about the Mass Commission for the Blind, but you also do want to advocate for tax reform. You want to do something that Bill suggests. You want to say, you know, some of us don't have a lot of money and we'd like a mobility option that we could afford, but some of us have been employed our entire lives. We're not against a kind of graduated fee for those who can afford it. We appreciate that everything costs money. We're not in the business just of asking government for help. We're also in the business of helping our government. We get it, as long as it's fair. There are lots of tactical discussions you guys need to have about how to concede, I'm not saying happily, but how to concede that Trump had half a point, to talk his language at times about post-identity politics, but to remind him that when you say you're going to help all of us, you better mean truly all of us. Here's my guess, and I'll just one other thought, and then I'll let you go. All of us detested the moment when he made fun of the New York Times reporter with cerebral palsy. I think he's going to feel that he needs to compensate for that. He's a kind of an elbow thrower. He'll be in your face on areas where he won't retreat. He wants that business, and he wants to look like a good guy. He's got a van. Listen, we're all egotistical, right? But Trump has redefined vanity. So let's play to that vanity. That's right. That's right. Thank you. Let's play to that vanity. Let's recognize that he wants to be universally admired, including admired by those of us with present or future disabilities. So let's give him a chance to make it up to us that he ridiculed that reporter. Let's not give up on him. We can play to his ego. We can play to that sense of vanity. We're down, but we're not out. Better times are ahead. Let's go to it. Thank you.
I've been reading about some proposed changes to Medicaid. I think it was in the New York Times about having people having to pay some subsidy and provide some work. It just seems like I'm hearing some real changes as to who will be eligible and how that's going to work out and what the qualifications will be.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had heard about that as well.
Yes, and I just want to get the other question because this other woman in the back row has raised her hand.
Thank you, Senator Barrett. My question is more Massachusetts, and I appreciate your changing. This is Jeannie Fairley. I'm the ADA coordinator for Newton. I am very frustrated by two bills that, and I want to know, do you have some strategies for us? And they're not strictly visually impaired. It's about disability. One of them is your co-senator, Representative Denise Provost, H.121, changing the language. If we can't even change the language, how can we change the policies? And the second one is Senate 1323 that we've all worked on trying to get the ADA and the Massachusetts Architectural Access Board. This helps all people with all different disabilities to be identical or to be the same. So in two sense, instances, Massachusetts is lagging behind. The federal government doesn't put out any more documents with the word handicapped. Does not. I've read and read and read a lot of stuff. It says disability, accessibility, and the ADA is a stricter force for accessibility. And why isn't Massachusetts matching up with it? And so these bills have been in the our legislature for, I don't know, 18 years, 10 years. It's so frustrating. If you can give us some strategies on that as well. Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to address all three issues that have just been raised, and then I am going to excuse myself. Thanks for indulging me and giving me so much time up here. Remember, all us politicians have big egos, so this is good. You're stroking me right now. You're gaining a friend. This is very clever of you. I think we're going to win the name change. I'm very optimistic. Tactically, though, I would recommend that we consider adding the name change again as a section, an outside section in the House and Senate budgets. I can't tell you why, and again, this makes no sense, but we don't pass legislation on anything. We're very unproductive if a bill has to start from scratch every 2 years. I'm not going to defend it. I'm just going to say that there are lots of gates and a lot of gatekeepers, and we don't get a bill from scratch past all of them very often. We pass a state budget every year, though, right? And when I'm talking about conditioning money, the change in nomenclature to get rid of the word handicapped can be added as an outside section conditioning the expenditures of money where disability is involved. And I'm not sure that we've ever tried it as an outside section or even an internal section to the budget, you know, for the expenditure of items for people with disabilities, striking any other references to those so benefited. I think we should try to amend the state budget to get at the wording thing. I'm totally with Denise, and with, I should say, the handicapped, the disability access is still called, there's another name we have to change in terms of that agency. So here's the issue there. Critically important. Let's talk tactics. Right now, there's a requirement that if you're mobility impaired, or for that matter, visually impaired, if you walk into a Bank of America branch, the public customer area has to be accessible to you. That's what the Americans with Disabilities Act mandates. Here was a compromise, though, made to the original ADA. We've celebrated the 25th anniversary this year. Omitted. Workspaces. The back office. So we're in the weird situation in Massachusetts of having the public customer space of the Bank of America accessible to all of us, but the workspace where the tellers sit can still discriminate. Now, businesses, especially small businesses, push back and say that making the workspaces, the back office, accessible involves enormous expense to them, and that's carried the day over my objections, I might add. I won't tell you how angry I've been about this, but it's prevailed so far. I'm really the chief in the Senate of pushing to make workspaces accessible. Here's how we're going to do this in the Trump era. Somebody flagged MassHealth. I should say Medicaid, of which MassHealth is the Massachusetts expression, and said, look, these people in Washington, including the new proposed Secretary of Health and Human Services, wants to create a work requirement, bring back the sort of workfare ideas of the 80s and 90s, a more conservative era. All right, they have the ability now to put that in effect. They've got the votes in the House to create a work requirement around Medicaid, MassHealth. They've got the votes in the Senate. They've got a president who may be amenable to it. Fine. Make us work. But create the damn spaces so that we can do the work. Make workspaces accessible so that you can implement your work requirement. That would be an example of is this jujitsu or something? You take the opponent's strengths and you deploy it against him. So we're none of us have an argument with work, provided that we're given the opportunity to do it. Let's make sure that both get passed at once. If there's going to be work requirements anywhere in MassHealth, those work environments ought to permit us to fulfill that mandate. We can figure out how to make the best of a challenging situation. One last word with respect to MassHealth. This really is where we're going to need your help. I see us making progress on technology. I see Trump in many ways wanting to emerge as a good guy after all, despite his ridiculing that New York Times reporter. I see things we can work, ways we can use the opposition's strength against him. But we need straight-out legislative work on MassHealth. This is going to be a tough one. I believe that blue states like ours are going to be discriminated against in the flow of federal monies. Over time, it's not going to happen overnight, but over the next 4 years, I think we're going to see health care for all, Romney care, if you will, Obamacare weakened in some important ways. We need you lobbying to keep MassHealth available and funded. And this is a straight out political fight. The governor is the key player here. He's I don't want to criticize Charlie Baker. For one thing, he takes more selfies than I do, which was very clever. So he's a smart guy, and he's cute, and he's talented. He's our weak link, though. He's the one who's going to be tempted to acquiesce to Trump because they're both Republicans and because he, Charlie Baker, needs to work with him in a way that Elizabeth Warren, who's going to be the voice of the opposition, does not need to do. I love Elizabeth Warren. She's my heroine. But she can afford to throw bombs in the next 4 years as the candidate of the eloquent opposition. Baker has to be the sausage maker. He has to figure out how to keep things somehow together for Massachusetts. We have to make sure that he doesn't target people with disabilities inadvertently as he goes along with Trump on changes to MassHealth, right? So we're going to really have to watch that one. Remember I talked about monitoring the details. It's all about the fine print here, folks. You've got the people who know the business, who know the State House. You've got many people like Denise Provost and me and others who can work with you. The MassHealth challenge, the Medicaid challenge, is very real, very threatening to all of us. And on that one, we're going to really have to be smart and vigilant. And even our friends, and I think Charlie Baker is a friend by and large to people with disabilities, even our friends are going to have to bear watching. Thank you very much.
That was State Senator Michael Barrett speaking to us at our fall conference last December. If you'd like to contact Senator Barrett, his phone number is 617-722-1572. That's 617-722-1572. Well, that about does it for Council Connection for March. If you have any questions or comments about the show or anything else, please leave a message for us in our BSCB mailbox at 617-923-4519. Don't forget that there's still a little bit of time to register for our upcoming convention, which will be on March 24th, 25th, and 26th. And you can register for the convention also by calling 617-923-4519. But you'd better hurry, because as of March 3rd, it's going to cost you more. I'm your host, Steve Dresser, and I hope you'll join us again in April when we return with another edition of Council Connection. Take care.